Osho, Vigyan Bhairav Tantra, Volume 1, The Book of the Secrets, A New Commentary, Discourse Number 1, given in Bombay, India.
Devi asks, O Shiva, what is your reality? What is this wonder-filled universe? What constitutes he? Who centers the universal being? What is this life beyond form, pervading form? How may we enter its fully, above its space and time?
Few introductory points. The world of Vigyan Bhairav Tantra is not intellectual. It is not philosophical. Doctrine is meaningless to it. It is concerned with method, with technique, not with principles at all. The word tantra means technique, the method, the path. So it is not philosophical, noted. It is not concerned with intellectual problems and inquiries. It is not concerned with why of things. It is concerned with how. Not what is truth, but how the truth can be attained. Tantra means technique. So this tetrad is a scientific one. Science is not concerned with why. Science is concerned with how. That is the basic difference between philosophy and science. Philosophy asks why this exists. Science asks how this is. The moment you ask the question how, method, technique becomes important. Theories become meaningless. Experience becomes the center. Tantra is science. Tantra is not philosophy. To understand philosophy is easy, because only your intellect is required. If you can understand language, if you can understand concepts, you can understand philosophy. You need not change. You require no transformation. As you are, you can understand philosophy, but not tantra. You will need a change, or rather a mutation. Unless you are different, Tantra cannot be understood. Because Tantra is not an intellectual proposition. It is an experience. Unless you are receptive, ready, vulnerable to the experience, it is not going to come to you. Philosophy is concerned with the mind. Your head is enough. Your totality is not required. Tantra needs you in your totality. It is a deeper challenge. You will have to be in it whole and soul. It is not fragmentary. A different approach, a different attitude, a different mind to receive it is required. Because of this, Devi is asking, of course, apparently philosophical questions. The Tantra starts with Devi's questions. All the questions can be tackled philosophically. Really, any question can be tackled in two ways, philosophically or totally, intellectually or existentially. For example, if someone asks what is love, you can tackle it intellectually. You can discuss, you can propose theories, you can argue for particular hypothesis, you can create a system, a doctrine, and you may not have known love at all. To create a doctrine, experience is not needed. Really, on the contrary, the less you know, the better. Because then you can propose a system unhesitatingly. Only a blind man can define what is light easily. When you don't know, you are bold. Ignorance is always bold. Knowledge hesitates. And the more you know, the more you feel the ground underneath is dissolving. The more you know, the more you feel how ignorant you are. And those who are really wise, they become ignorant. They become as simple as children, or as simple as idiots. The less you know, the better to be philosophic, to be dogmatic, to be doctrinaire. This is easy. To tackle a problem intellectually is very easy. But to tackle a problem existentially, not just to think about it, but to live it through, to go through it, to allow yourself to be transformed through it, that is, to know love one will have to be in love. That is dangerous. Because you will not remain the same. The experience is going to change you. The moment you enter love, you enter a different person. And then you will come out, you will not be able to recognize your old face. It will not belong to you. A discontinuity has happened. Now there is a gap. The old man is dead, and the new man has come. That's what is known as rebirth, being twice born. Tantra is non-philosophical and existential. So of course Devi asks questions which appear to be philosophical, but Shiva is not going to answer them that way. So better to understand it in the beginning, because otherwise you will be puzzled. Because Shiva is not going to answer a single question. All the questions Devi is asking, Shiva is not going to answer at all. And still he answers. And really only he has answered them and no one else. But on a different plane. Devi asks, what is your reality, my Lord? He is not going to answer it. On the contrary, he will give a technique. And if Devi goes through this technique, she will know. So the answer is roundabout. It is not direct. He is not going to say, who am I? He will give a technique. Do it and you know it. For Tantra, doing is knowing. And there is no other knowing. Unless you do something, unless you change, unless you have a different perspective to look at, to look with, unless you move in a different dimension altogether than the intellect, there is no answer. Answers can be given. They are all lies. All philosophies are lies. You ask a question and the philosophy gives you an answer. It satisfies you or doesn't satisfy you. If it satisfies you, you become a convert to the philosophy. You remain the same. If it doesn't satisfy you, you go on searching for some other philosophy to be converted. But you remain the same. You are not touched at all. You are not changed. So whether you are a Hindu or a Mohammedan or a Christian or a Jain, it makes no difference. The real person behind the facade of a Hindu or a Mohammedan or a Christian is the same. Only words differ. Are clothes. The man who is going to the church and to the temple and to the mosque is the same man. Only faces differ. And they are faces false, masks. Behind the mask you will find the same man. The same anger, the same aggression, the same violence, the same greed, the same lust. Everything the same. Is Mohammedan sexuality different from Hindu sexuality? Is a Christian violence different from a Hindu violence? It is the same. The reality remains the same, only clothes differ. Tantra is not concerned with your clothes. Tantra is concerned with you. If you ask a question, it shows where you are. It shows also that wherever you are, you cannot see. That's why the question. A blind man asks, what is light? Philosophy will start answering, what is light? Tantra will know only this, that if a man is asking what is light, it shows simply only this, that he is blind. Tantra will start operating on the man, changing the man so that he can see. Tantra will not say what is light. Tantra will say how to attain insight, how to attain seeing, how to attain vision. When the vision is there, the answer will be there. Tantra will not give you the answer. Tantra will give you the technique, how to attain the answer. Now, this answer is not going to be intellectual. If you say something about light to a blind man, this is intellectual. If the blind man himself becomes capable of seeing, this is existential. This is what I mean, Tantra is existential. So Shiva is not going to answer Devi's questions. Still, he will answer the first thing. The second thing, this is a different type of language. You must know something about it before we enter into it. All the tantra treatises are dialogues between Shiva and Devi. Devi questions and Shiva answers. All the tantra treatises start that way. Why? Why this method? It is very significant. It is not a dialogue between a teacher and a disciple. It is a dialogue between two lovers. And Tantra signifies for it a very meaningful thing. The deeper teaching cannot be given unless there is love between the two, the disciple and the teacher. The disciple and teacher must become deeply lovers. Only then the higher, the beyond can be expressed. So it is a language of love. The disciple must be in an attitude of love. Not only this, because friends can be lovers. But Tantra says a disciple means a receptivity. So the disciple must be in a feminine receptivity. Only then. You need not be a woman to be a disciple, but you need to be in a feminine attitude of receptivity. Devi asks, it means the feminine attitude asks.
Why this emphasis on feminine attitude? Man and woman are not only physically different, they are psychologically different. Sex is not only a difference in the bodies, it is a difference in psychologies also. A feminine mind means receptivity, total receptivity, surrender, love. A disciple needs a feminine psychology, otherwise he will not be able to learn. You can ask, but if you are not open, then you cannot be answered. You can ask a question and it's still remaining closed, then the answer cannot penetrate you. Your doors are closed. You are dead. You are not open. A feminine receptivity means a womb-like receptivity in the inner depth, so you can receive. And not only that, much more is implied. A woman is not only receiving something. The moment she receives it, it becomes a part of her body. A child is received. A woman conceives. The moment there is conception, the child has become part of the feminine body. It is not alien. It is not foreign. It has been absorbed. Now the child will live, not as something added to the mother, but just a part, just as the mother. And the child is not only received, the feminine body becomes creative. The child begins to grow. A disciple means a womb-like receptivity. Whatsoever is received is not to be gathered as a dead knowledge. It must grow in you. It must become blood and bones in you. It must be a part now. It must grow. This growth will change, will transform the receiver. That's why Tantra uses this device. Every tirthi starts with Devi asking a question and Shiva replying it. Devi is Shiva's concert, his feminine part. One thing more. Now, modern psychology, depth psychologically, particularly, says that man is both. Man and woman. No one is just male and no one is just female. Everyone is bisexual. Both sexes are there. But this is a very recent research in the West. But for Tantra, this has been one of the most basic conceptions for thousands of years. You must have seen some picture of Shiva as Ardhanarishwar, half man, half woman. That is the only concept in the whole history of man. Shiva is depicted as half man, half woman. So Devi is not just a concept, it is Shiva's other half. And unless a disciple becomes the other half of the teacher, it is impossible to convey the higher teachings, the esoteric methods When you become one, then there is no doubt. When you are one with the teacher, so subtly one, so deeply one, there is no argument, no logic, no reason. One simply absorbs. One becomes a womb, and then the teaching begins to grow and change you. That's why Tantra is written in love language. Something must be understood about love language also. There are two types of languages: logic language and love language. There are basic differences between the two. Logic language is aggressive, argumentative, violent. If I use a logic language, I become aggressive on your mind. I try to convince you, to convert you, to make a puppet of you. My argument is right and you are wrong. Logic language is egocentric. I am right and you are wrong. So I must prove that I am right and you are wrong. I am not concerned with you. I am concerned with my ego. My ego is always right. Love language is totally different. I am not concerned with my ego. I am concerned with you. I am not concerned to prove something, to strengthen my ego. I am concerned to help you. It is a compassion. To help you to grow, to help you to transform, to help you to be reborn. Secondly, logic will always be intellectual. Concepts, principles will be significant. Arguments will be significant. With love language, what is said is not so significant. Rather, the way it is said. The container, the word, is not important. The content, the message, is more important. It is a heart-to-heart talk, not a mind-to-mind discussion. It is not a debate. It is a communion. So this is rare. Parvati is sitting in the lap of Shiva and asking. And Shiva answers. It is the love dialogue. No conflict. As if Shiva is speaking to himself. Why this emphasis on love? Love language. Because if you are in love with your teachers, then the whole gestalt changes. It becomes different. Then you are not hearing his words. Then you are drinking him. Then words are irrelevant. Really, the silence between the words becomes more significant. What he is saying may be meaningful, may not be meaningful, but his eyes, his gestures, his compassion, his love, That's why Tantra has a fixed device, a structure. Every tithe starts with Devi asking and Shiva answering. No argument is going to be there. No wastage of words. Very simple statements of fact. Telegraphic messages. With no view to convince, just to relate. Shiva, if you encounter him with a question, with a closed mind, will not answer you in this way. Because first your closing has to be broken, then he will have to be aggressive, then your prejudices, then your preconceptions, they have to be destroyed. Unless you are cleared completely of your past, nothing can be given to you. But this is not so. With his concert Devi, there is no past. Remember, when you are deep in love, your mind ceases to be. There is no past. Only the present moment becomes everything. When you are in love, the present is the only time. The now is all. No past, no future. So Devi is just open. There is no defense. Nothing to be cleared. Nothing to be destroyed. The ground is ready. Only a seed has to be dropped. The ground is not only ready but welcoming, receptive, asking to be impregnated. So all these things that we are going to discuss will be telegraphic. They are just sutras. But each sutra, each telegraphic message given by Shiva is worth a Veda, worth a Bible, worth a Quran. Each single sentence can become the base of a great scripture. Because scriptures are logical. You have to propose, defend, argue. There is no argument. Simple statements of love. Thirdly, Vijnana Bhairava Tantra. The very word means the technique of going beyond consciousness. Vijnan means consciousness. Bhairav means the state which is beyond consciousness. And Tantra means the method. The method of going beyond consciousness. This is the supreme doctrine, without any doctrine. We are unconscious. So all the religious teachings are concerned how to go beyond unconsciousness, how to be conscious. For example, Krishnamurti, Zen, they are all concerned how to create more consciousness, because we are unconscious. So how to be more aware, alert? From unconsciousness, how to move towards consciousness? But Tantra says that this is a duality, unconscious and conscious. If you move from unconscious to consciousness, you are moving from one duality to another. Move beyond both. Unless you move beyond both, you can never reach the ultimate. So neither be unconscious nor be conscious. Just go beyond. Just be. Neither be conscious nor be unconscious. Just be. This is going beyond yoga, going beyond Zen, going beyond all teachings. Vigyan means consciousness, and Bhairav is a specific term, tantra term, for that who has gone beyond. That's why Shiva is known as Bhairav and Devi is known as Bhairavi. Those who have gone beyond all dualities. In our experience, only love can give us a glimpse. That's why love becomes the very basic device to impart tantra wisdom. In our experience, only love is something we can say which goes beyond duality. When two persons are in love, the deeper they move in it, less and less they are two. More and more they become one. And a point comes and the peak is reached when only apparently there are two, inwardly there are one. The duality is transcended. Only in this sense Jesus saying that God is love becomes meaningful, otherwise not. In our experience, love is nearest to God. Not that God is loving, as Christians go on interpreting. That God has a fatherly love for you. Nonsense. God is love is a tantra statement. It means love is the only reality in our experience which approximately reaches nearest to God, to the divine. Why? Because in love, oneness is felt. Bodies remain two, and something beyond the bodies merges and becomes one. That's why so much hankering after sex. The real hankering is after oneness, but that oneness is not sexual. In sex, only two bodies have a deceptive feeling of becoming one. They are not one. They are only joined together. But for a single moment, two bodies forget into each other. and a certain physical oneness is felt, this hankering is not bad, but to stop at it is dangerous. This hankering shows a deeper urge to feel oneness. In love, on a higher plane, the inner one moves, merges into the others, and there is a feeling of oneness. Duality dissolves. Only in this non-dual love we can have a glimpse of what is the state of a bhairav. We may say that the state of bhairav is absolute love, no coming back from the peak of love, no falling back, remaining on the peak. We have made Shiva's abode on Kailas. That is simply symbolic. The highest peak, the holiest peak. We have made it Shiva's abode. We can go there, but we will have to come down. It cannot be our abode. We can go on a pilgrimage. It is a tirthyatra, a pilgrimage, a journey. We can touch for a single moment the highest peak, then we will have to come back. In love, this holy pilgrimage happens, but not for all. Because no one moves beyond sex. So we go on living in the valleys, dark valleys. Sometimes someone moves to the peak of love, but then falls back because it is so dizzy. It is so high, and you are so low, and it is so difficult to live there. Those who have loved, they know how it is difficult to be constantly in love. One has to come back again and again. It is Shiva's abode. He lives there. It is his home. A bhairav lives in love. That's his abode. When I say that's his abode, I mean, now he is not even aware of love. Because if you live on Kailas, you will not be aware that this is Kailas. This is a peak. The peak becomes a plinth. Shiva is not aware of love. We are aware of love because we live in non-love. And because of the contrast, we feel love. Shiva is love. The state of bhairav means one who has become love, not loving. One who has become love. One who lives on the peak. The peak has become his abode. How to make this highest peak possible? Beyond duality, beyond unconsciousness, beyond consciousness, beyond the body and beyond the soul. Beyond the world and beyond the so-called moksha. How to reach this peak? The technique is tantra. But Tantra is pure technique. So it is going to be difficult to understand. First, let us understand the questions, what Devi is asking. O Shiva, what is your reality? Why this question? You can also ask this question, but it will not carry the same meaning. So try to understand it. Why Devi asks, what is your reality? Devi is in deep love. When you are in deep love, for the first time, you encounter the inner reality. Then Shiva is not the form. Then Shiva is not the body. When you are in love, the body of the beloved falls, disappears. The form is no more, and the formless is revealed. You are facing an abyss. That's why we are so afraid of love. We can face a body. We can face a face. We can face a form. We are afraid of facing an abyss. If you love someone, if you really love, his body is bound to disappear. In some moments of climax, of peak, the form will dissolve. And through the beloved, you will enter the formless. That's why we are afraid. It is falling into a bottomless abyss. So this question is not just a simple curiosity. O Shiva, what is your reality? Devi must have fallen in love with the form. Things start that way. She must have loved this man as man. And now when the love has come of age, when the love has flowered, this man has disappeared. He has become formless. Now he is to be found nowhere. O Shiva, what is your reality? It is a question asked in a very intense love moment. And questions become different with the mind in which they are asked. The moment they are raised. So create the situation, the milieu of the question in our minds. Parvati must be at a loss. Devi must be at a loss. Shiva has disappeared. When love reaches its peak, the lover disappears. Why this happens? This happens because really everyone is formless. You are not a body. You move as a body. You live as a body, but you are not a body. When we see someone from the outside, he is a body. Love penetrates within. Then we are not seeing the person from the outside. Love can see the person as the person can see himself from within, then the form disappears. Zen monk Rinchai attained his enlightenment, and the first thing he asserted, where is my body? Where my body has gone? And he began to search. And he called his disciples and he said, go and find out where is my body. I have lost my body. He has entered the formless. You are also a formless existence. But you know yourself not directly. You know from others' eyes. You know through the mirror. Sometimes, looking at the mirror, close your eyes and then think, meditate. If there was no mirror, how could you have known your face? If there was no mirror, there would have been no face. You don't have face. Mirrors give you faces. Then think of a world there is no mirror. You are alone. No mirror at all. Not even others' eyes working as mirrors. You are alone on a lonely island. No, nothing can mirror you. Then will you have any face? Or will you have any body? You cannot have. You are not having it at all. Because we know ourselves through others. And the others can know only the outer form. That's why we become identified with it. Another Zen mystic, Huihai, used to say to his disciples, meditating, when you lose your head, come immediately to me. When you lose your head, come immediately to me. When you begin to feel there is no head, don't be afraid. Come immediately to me. This is the right moment. Now something can be taught to you. With a head, no teaching is possible. The head always comes in between. Parvati Devi asks Shiva, O Shiva, what is your reality? Who you are? The form has disappeared. Hence the question. In love, you enter the other as himself. It is not you entering. You become one, and for the first time, you know an abyss, just a formless presence. That's why, for centuries altogether, centuries and centuries, we were not making any sculpture, any picture of Shiva. We were making only Shivalinga, the symbol. Shivalinga is just a formless form. When you love someone, when you enter someone, he becomes just a luminous presence. That Shivalinga is just a luminous presence. Just an aura of light. That's why baby asks, what is your reality? What is this wonderful universe? We know the universe, but we never know it as wonderful. Children know, lovers know, sometimes poets and madmen. We don't know that the world is wonderful. Everything is just repetitive, no wonders, no poetry, just flat prose. It doesn't create a song in you. It doesn't create a dance in you. It doesn't give birth to a poetry inside. The whole universe looks mechanical. Children look at it with wonder-filled eyes. When the eyes are wonder-filled, the universe is wonder-filled. When you are in love, you again become like children. Jesus says, only those who are like children will enter my kingdom of God. Why? Because if the universe is not a wonder, you cannot be religious. The universe can be explained, then your approach is scientific. The universe is known or unknown, but that which is unknown can be known any day. But it is not unknowable. The universe becomes unknowable, a mystery, only when your eyes are wonder-filled. Devi says, what is this wonder-filled universe? And suddenly the jump from a personal question to a very impersonal one. She was asking, what is your reality? And then suddenly, what is this wonderful universe? When form disappears, your beloved becomes the universe, the formless, the infinite. Suddenly, Devi becomes aware. She is not asking a question about Shiva. She is asking a question about the whole universe. Now the Shiva has become the whole universe. Now all the stars are moving in him. And the whole firmament and the whole space is surrounded by him. Now he is the great engulfing factor, the great encompassing. Jasper has defined God as the great encompassing. When you enter in love, in a deep, intimate world of love, the person disappears, the form disappears, and the lover becomes just a door to the universe. Your curiosity can be a scientific one. Then you have to approach through logic. Then you must not think of the formless. Then beware of formless. Then remain content with the form. So science is always concerned with the form. If anything formless is proposed to a scientific mind, he will cut it into forms. Unless it takes a form, it is meaningless. First, give it a form, a definite form, only then the inquiry starts. In love, if there is form, then there is no entry. Dissolve the form. When things become formless, dizzy, without boundaries, everything entering another, the whole universe becomes oneness. Then only it is a wonder-filled universe. What constitutes seed? Then she goes on. From the universe, she asks, what constitutes the seed? This formless, this wonderful universe, from where it comes, from where it originates, or it originates not? What is the seed? Who centers the universal wheel? This wheel goes on moving and moving, this great change, this constant flux. But who centers this wheel? Where is the axis? The center, the unmoving center. She doesn't stop for any answers. She goes on asking. As if she is not asking anyone, talking to herself. What is this life beyond form, pervading forms? How may we enter it fully, above space and time, names and descriptions? Let my doubts be cleared. The emphasis is not on questions, but on doubts. Let my doubts be cleared. This is very significant. If you are asking an intellectual question, you are asking for a definite answer, so that your problem is solved. But Devi says, let my doubts be cleared. She is not really asking about answers, she is asking for a transformation of her mind. Because a doubting mind will remain a doubting mind, whatsoever answers are given. Note it. A doubting mind will remain a doubting mind. Answers are irrelevant. If I give you one answer and you have a doubting mind, you will doubt it. If I give you another answer, you will doubt that also. You have a doubting mind. Doubting mind means it will put a question mark to anything. So answers are useless. You ask me who created the world, and I say you A created the world, then you are bound to ask who created A. So the real problem is not how to answer questions. The real problem is how to change the doubting mind. How to create a mind which is not doubting, or which is trustful. So Devi says, let my doubts be cleared. Two or three things more. When you ask a question, you may be asking for many reasons. One may be just this, that you want a confirmation. You already know the answer. You have the answer. You just want to be confirmed that your answer is right. Then your question is false, pseudo. It is not a question. You may be asking a question, not because that you are ready to change yourself, but only just as a curiosity. The mind goes on questioning. In the mind, questions come as leaves come in a tree. That is the very nature of the mind, to question. So it goes on questioning. It matters not what you are questioning. Anything give to the mind, it will create a question. It is a grinding machine to create questions. So give it anything, it will cut it into pieces and create many questions. One question answered, and the mind will create many questions from the answer. This has been the whole history of philosophy. Bertrand Russell remembers that when he was a child, he thought that one day, when he will be mature enough to understand all philosophy, all questions will be answered. Then late, when he was 80, he said that now I can say that my old questions are there, standing as they were standing when I was a child. New other questions have come up because of the study of philosophy. So he said, when I was young, I used to say philosophy is an inquiry for ultimate answers. Now I cannot say this. It is an inquiry for endless questions. So one question creates one answer and many questions. The doubting mind is the problem. Parvati says, don't be concerned with my questions. I have asked so many things. What is your reality? What is this wonderful universe? What constitutes seed? Who centers the universal wheel? What is life beyond forms? How we can enter it fully above time and space? But don't be concerned with my questions. Let my doubts be cleared. I ask these questions because they are in my mind. I ask them just to show you my mind, but don't pay much attention to them. Really, answers will not fulfill my need. My need is let my doubts be cleared. But how the doubts can be cleared? Will any answer do? Is there any answer which will clear your doubts? Mind is the doubt. It is not that the mind doubts. Mind is the doubt. Unless the mind dissolves, doubts cannot be cleared. Shiva will answer. His answers are techniques. The oldest, the most ancient techniques, but you can call them latest also, because nothing can be added to them. They are complete. 112 techniques. They have taken all the possibilities, all the ways of killing the mind. transcend the mind. Not a single method could be added to Shiva's 112 methods, and this book, Vigyan Bhairav Tantra, is 5,000 years old. Nothing can be added. There is no possibility to add anything. It is exhaustive, complete. And the most ancient, and yet the latest, yet the newest, old like old hills, the scene eternal, and new like just a dewdrop before the sun, because they are so fresh. These 112 methods of meditation constitute the whole science of transforming mind. We will enter one by one. We will try to comprehend first intellectually, but use your intellect only as an instrument, not as a master. Use it as an instrument to understand something, but don't go on creating barriers by it. When we will be talking these techniques, just put aside your past knowledge, your knowing, whatsoever informations you have collected, put them aside. They are just dust gathered on the road. Encounter these methods with a fresh mind, with alertness, of course, but not with argumentation. And don't make the fallacy that argumentative mind is alert mind. It is not. Because the moment you move into arguments, you have lost the awareness, you have lost the alertness. You are not here then. These methods don't belong to any religion, remember. They are not Hindu. Just as the theory of relativity is not Jewish, because Einstein conceived it and radio and television are not Christian. No one says that why you are using electricity, this is Christian, because the Christian mind conceived it. Science doesn't belong to races and to religions, and Tantra is a science. So remember, this is not Hindu at all. These techniques were conceived by Hindus, but those techniques are not Hindu. That's why these techniques will not mention any religious rituals. No temple is needed. You are quite a temple yourself. You are the lab. The whole experiment is to go on within you. No belief is needed. This is not religion. This is science. No belief is needed. It is not required to believe in Quran or the Veda or Buddha or in Mahavir. No. No belief is needed. Only a daring to experiment is enough. Courage to experiment is enough. That's why the beauty a Mohammedan can practice, and he will reach to the deeper meanings of Quran. A Hindu can practice, and he will for the first time know what Veda is. And a Zen can practice, and a Buddhist can practice. They need not leave their religions. Tantra will fulfill them wherever they are. Tantra will be helpful whatsoever their chosen path. So remember this, Tantra is pure science. You may be a Hindu or a Mohammedan or a Parsi or whatsoever. Tantra doesn't touch your religion at all. Tantra says that religion is a social affair. So belong to any religion, it is irrelevant. But you can transform yourself. And that transformation needs a scientific methodology. When you are ill, you have fallen ill, or you have caught tuberculosis, or anything, then, whether you are a Hindu or a Mohammedan, it makes no difference. The tuberculosis remains indifferent to your Hinduism, to your Mohammedanism, to your beliefs, political, social, or religious. Tuberculosis has to be treated scientifically. There is no Hindu tuberculosis, no Mohammedan tuberculosis. You are ignorant. You are in conflict. You are asleep. This is a disease, a spiritual disease. This disease has to be treated by the Tantra. You are irrelevant. Your beliefs are irrelevant. This is just a coincidence that you are born somewhere and someone else is born somewhere else. This is just a coincidence. Your religion is a coincidence. So don't cling to it. Use some scientific methods to transform yourself. Tantra is not very well known. Or even if known, then very much misunderstood. There are reasons for it. Higher and purer a science, the less is the possibility of it that masses should know. We have only heard the name of relativity, theory of relativity. It was used to be said that only 12 persons understood it when Einstein was alive all over the world. Only 12 minds could understand it. It was difficult even for Albert Einstein to make it understand to someone, to make it understandable, because it moves so high, it goes above your heads. But it can be understood. A technical, mathematical knowledge is needed. A training is needed, and it can be understood. But Tantra is more difficult, because no training will help. Only transformation can help. That's why Tantra could never become a mass understanding. And this happens always when you cannot understand a thing, you will misunderstand at least. Because then you can feel, okay, I understand. You cannot simply remain in the queue. Secondly, when you cannot understand a thing, you begin to abuse it. Because it insults you. You cannot understand it. You and cannot understand it. That is impossible. Something must be wrong with the thing itself. One begins to abuse. One begins to talk nonsense and then feels, no, it is okay. So Tantra was not understood. Tantra was misunderstood. It was so deep and so high that this was natural. Secondly, because Tantra moves beyond duality, the very standpoint is amoral. Please understand this word. Moral, immoral, amoral. We understand morality, we understand immorality. It becomes difficult if something is amoral beyond both. Tantra is amoral. Look at in this way. A medicine is amoral. It is neither moral nor immoral. If you give it to a thief, it will help. If you give it to a saint, it will help. It will make no difference between a thief and a saint. The medicine cannot say, this is a thief, so I am going to kill him. And this is a saint, so I am going to help him. A medicine is a scientific thing. Your being a thief or being a saint is irrelevant. Tantra is amoral. Tantra says no morality is needed. No particular morality is needed. On the contrary, you are immoral because you have a very disturbed mind. So Tantra cannot make it a condition that first you become moral and then you can practice Tantra. Because Tantra says this is absurd. Someone is ill, feverish, and the doctor comes and he says, first bring down your fever. First, be quite healthy. Only then I can give you the medicine. This is what is happening. One thief comes to a saint and he says, I am a thief. Tell me how to meditate. He says, first leave your profession. How can you meditate if you remain a thief? One alcoholic comes and he says, I am an alcoholic. How I can meditate? So the first condition is to leave alcohol. And only then you can meditate. The condition becomes suicidal. The man is alcoholic, or a thief, or immoral, because he has a disturbed mind, ill mind. These are the effects, consequences of a diseased mind. And you say, first be well, and then you can meditate. But then who needs meditation? Meditation is medicinal. It is a medicine. Tantra is immoral. It doesn't ask you who you are. Your being a man is enough. Wherever you are, whatsoever you are accepted. Choose a technique which fits you and put your all energy into it, and you will not be the same again. Real, authentic techniques always will be like that. If I make preconditions, they say, I have a pseudo-technique. I say, first do this and first do not do that, and then. And those are impossible conditions. Because a thief can change his objects, but he cannot become a no-thief. A greedy man can change his objects of greed, but he cannot become non-greedy. You can force him, or he can force upon himself non-greed also, only because of a certain greed. If heaven is promised, he may even try to be non-greedy. But this is greed par excellence. Heaven, moksha, Satchidananda, they become the objects of his greed. Tantra says you cannot change man unless you give him authentic techniques to change. Just by preaching, nothing is changed. And you can see all over the world, whatsoever Tantra says, is written all over the world. So much preaching, so much moralizing, so many priests, preachers, the whole world filled with them. And so ugly. And everything immoral. Why this is happening? The same will be the case if you give your hospitals to preachers. They will go there and they will start preaching, and they will make every ill man guilty that you are guilty. You have created this disease. Now change this disease. If preachers are given hospitals, what will be the condition of hospitals? The same is the condition of the whole world. Preachers go on preaching. They go on telling people, don't be angry, without giving any technique. And we have heard this teaching for so long that we never raise even a question that what are you telling me? I'm angry and you simply say, don't be angry. How this is possible? When I am angry, it means I am anger. And you tell me just, don't be angry. So only I can suppress myself. That will create more anger. That will create guilt. Because if I try to change and cannot change myself, that creates inferiority. That gives me a feeling of guilt that only I am incapable. I cannot win my anger. No one can win. You need certain weapons. You need certain techniques. Because your anger is just an indication of a disturbed mind. Change the disturbed mind and the indication will change. Anger is just sowing what is within. Change the within and the without will change. So Tantra is not concerned with your so-called moralities. Really, to emphasize morality is mean. It is degrading. It is inhuman. When someone comes to me and I say, leave anger first, leave sex first, leave this and that, I am inhuman. What I am saying is impossible. And the impossibility will make that man feel inwardly mean. He will begin to feel inferior. He will be degraded inside, in his own eyes. And if he tries the impossible, he is going to be a failure. And when he is a failure, he will be convinced that he is a sinner. The preachers have convinced the whole world that you are sinners. This is good for them, because unless you are convinced, their profession cannot continue. You must be sinners, only then churches, temples and mosques can continue to prosper. Your being in sin is their season. Your guilt is the base of all the highest churches. The more guilty you are, the church will go rising higher and higher. It is, they are built on your guilt, on your sin, on your inferiority complex. So they have created inferior humanity. Tantra is not concerned with your morality, so-called social formalities, etc. That doesn't mean that Tantra says be moral. No. Tantra is so much unconcerned with your morality that Tantra cannot say be moral. Tantra gives you scientific techniques how to change the mind. And once the mind is different, your character will be different. Once the basis of your structure changes, your whole edifice will be different. Because of this immoral attitude, Tantra could not be tolerated by your so-called saints. They all went against it. Because if Tantra succeeds, then all this nonsense which goes on in the name of religion will have to stop. See this. Christianity fought very much scientific progress. Why? Only because if scientific progress is there in the material world, then it is not very far. But in the psychological, in the spiritual also, science will penetrate. So Christianity started fighting scientific progress. Because once you know that you can change matter through techniques, it is not very far, you will come to know that you can change mind through techniques. Because mind is nothing but subtle matter. This is tantra proposition. Mind is nothing but subtle matter. It can be changed. And once you have a different mind, you have a different world. Because you look through the mind. The world you are seeing because of a particular mind. Change the mind and you look. There is a different world. And if there is no mind, that is the ultimate for Tantra. To bring a state when there is no mind, then look at the world without any mediator. When the mediator is not, you are encountering the real. Because now no one is between you and the real. And nothing can be distorted. So Tantra says, when there is no mind, that is the state of Bhairav, no mind state. For the first time you look a world, that which is. If you have a mind, you go on creating a world. You go on imposing, projecting. So first change the mind, then change from mind to no mind, and these 112 methods can help each and everyone. Any particular method may not be of your use. That's why Shiva goes on relating many methods. Choose any one method which suits you. It is not difficult to know which suits you. We will try to understand each method. And how to choose for yourself one method which can change you and your mind. This will be a basic necessity, this understanding, intellectual understanding. But this is not the end. Whatsoever I talk here, try it. Really, when you try the right method, it ticks immediately. So I will go on talking methods here every day. You try. Just play with them. Go home, try. The right method, whenever you happen to it, just ticks. Something explodes in you. And you know that this is the right method for me. But effort is needed. And you may be surprised suddenly one day that one method has taken your grip. So while I will be talking here, parallel to it, go on playing with these methods. I say playing. Because don't be too much serious. Just play. Something may fit you. If it fits you, then be serious. And then go deep in it, intensely, honestly, with your all energy, with all your mind. But before that, just play. I have found that while you are playing, your mind is more open. While you are serious, your mind is not so open, it is closed. So just play. Don't be too serious. Just play. And these methods are simple. You can play with them. Take one method, play with it for at least 3 days. If it gives you a certain feeling of affinity, if it gives you a certain feeling of well-being, if it gives you a certain feeling that this is for you, then be serious about it. Then forget. Then don't play with other matters. Then stick to it at least for 3 months. Miracles are possible. The only thing is the technique must be for you. If the technique is not for you, then nothing happens. And you may go on with it for lives together, nothing will happen. If the method is for you, then even 3 minutes are enough. So these 112 methods can be a miraculous experience for you, or they may be just listening. It depends on you. I will go on describing each method from as many angles as possible. If you feel any affinity with it, play with it for 3 days, then leave it. If you feel that it fits, something clicks in you, continue it for 3 months. Life is a miracle. If you have not known its mystery, that only shows you don't know the technique, how to approach it. Shiva proposes 112 methods. These are all the methods possible. If nothing clicks and nothing gives you the feeling that this is for you, then there is no method for you left. Remember this. Then forget the spirituality. Be at ease. Then it is not for you. But these 112 methods are for the whole humanity, for all the ages that have passed and all the ages that has to come. For all time, there has never been a single man, and there will never be, who can say these 112 methods are all useless for me. Impossible. This is impossible. Every type of mind has been taken, accounted. Every type of possible mind has been given a technique in it. There are many techniques for which no man exists yet. They are for future. There are many